Hello and welcome in.
Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio.
Good morning. This week on Science Mixtape, we look at machine learning. Yes, that's right. This week on Science Mixtape, I am joined by Jack Fitzsimmons, who is studying his PhD with the Oxford University Machine Learning Research Group. He's helped to build a robot, given it its eyes, worked for NASA, and is now looking at more in-depth machine learning algorithms. We will be hearing more about his fascinating research later in the show. But Jack, just to get us off on the right track, now, when we talk about machine learning, I've got images of like a bunch of little robots going to robot school and you're their teacher, but I'm sure that's not what's actually happening. So could you just explain very briefly what machine learning is?
Yeah, sure. Machine learning is basically any system which improves at a task as it is performing the task. So it's not a brain, it's not like, you know, replacing humans or anything. It's just something that gets better as it does its job.
So it's learning from experience.
Learning from experience, yeah.
Amazing. Okay, so we're going to find out all about how you program those machines to do what they're doing. But also coming up in the show, instead of a weekly experiment, we've got more of a thought experiment that's going to really help demonstrate some of the work that Jack does. So Jack, if you want to set us off, could you just describe this thought experiment to get our listeners at home thinking about it?
Sure. So this is a really well-known probability problem, which is called the Monty Hall problem. So the idea is you're at you're about to win some prize on a game show, and there's three doors, and there's a prize behind one, but not the other two.
And typically it's a car, isn't it?
Yeah.
So there's a car behind one door and two goats behind the other two doors.
Yeah, details. So you pick door number two, let's say.
Yeah.
And after picking door number two, the game show host tries to test you and says, ah, and opens door number three and shows you that actually there was a goat behind door number three. He then gives you the opportunity to change from door two to door one. Should you change or should you not? That's the question.
So that is the question. If you think you should change your doors, you can tweet us at Soho Radio. And if you think you should stay with your original choice, you should also tweet us. We want to know what you think, and we will be revealing the answer to that later in the show. Now, Jack, you've chosen the music for us today. So what are we kicking off with?
Let's go for a classic. It's from the soundtrack of Back to the Future. Huey Lewis.
And Back in Time.
Take me away, I don't mind. You better promise me I'll be back in time. Come on. Gotta get back in time. Here we go now. Go back to the future. I wanna roll on the dice. Back to remember. Lightning never strikes twice.
News.
Yes, this week, amazing science news. We have found water, flowing water on Mars. This is super exciting because flowing water, or sort of liquid water, means that there is a much greater chance that we can find life actually on Mars. And it's so cool. It was actually discovered by a student doing an undergrad back in 2011. He was looking at some pictures taken by the Mars. Jack's making a face at me. Do you disagree?
Well, I think the history of water on Mars dates back a little bit further than that. So I think like I did a quick Google Scholar search on my way over, and the first paper on it was like in 1977. But this is a big PR thing for NASA, so it's very important, and I think they've actually kind of like proved it now as opposed to speculated for a long time.
Yeah. Okay, so it was basically they were looking at some pictures taken by the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, which showed dark streaks on the surface that lengthened and darkened or then disappeared as the seasons changed. And these sort of only possible one of the explanations for this was that it was actually sort of water appearing and disappearing, and it seems to be there when you've got temperatures that are warmer than minus 23 degrees, which doesn't sound that warm, and it disappears at colder times. And they've also determined that this is salty water, not pure water. It'd be too cold for pure water. That would be ice. And looking at the kind of infrared spectrums that have come off it, they've like confirmed that there are hydrated salts in that. And what I read was that it's a bit like in the Atacama Desert in Bolivia, that the salts there in the sort of really arid, dry environment actually are able to take water out of the atmosphere, and that is what has allowed life, like little bacteria life, to grow in the Atacama Desert. So I don't know. I don't know if there's enough moisture in Mars's atmosphere for that to actually be the cause, but it's a step towards, could there be life?
So I think one of the really funny side stories that came off this as well was the director, I think, or producer of the new movie Martian.
Yes.
Ridley Scott had an interview with The Guardian with a guy called Andrew Pulver,
mm-hmm.
and has now kind of claimed part responsibility for it. He's like, oh yeah, I was talking to the NASA team and they were, you know, helping us, you know, create a realistic Mars. And they were talking about the ice and I was like, oh, does that mean that, you know, Earth was like, you know, this is kind of like Earth in 750 million years. And they were like, oh yeah, we'll look into that. Like, yeah, film producer / scientist, maybe? Not sure.
I heard a conspiracy theory. They were like, water found on Mars the same time that Martians release. It's obviously just like a publicity stunt.
Well, I think they did have, you know, signs for a long time, so.
No, of course. That was like obviously just someone having a go at Ridley Scott. But I liked it as a concept. Yeah, so before we've only ever known of ancient water on Mars, like the Curiosity rover has confirmed that Mars was wet for like 1.5 billion years, which is much longer than the period of time that was needed for life to develop on Earth. But yeah, we'd only ever known of ancient water or frozen water. We know that the surface is frozen, so flowing water, an amazing new step. And the next step, can they find the source? Is it coming from the atmosphere or is it coming from beneath the frozen surface? Lots to speculate on there. The other very exciting story that happened this week was the lunar eclipse. Did you see it?
I've only seen pictures of it, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, fair, it was at 4 a.m. I was actually on a plane at the time, and a terrible scientist that I am, I wasn't aware that it was going to be happening. And then our pilot was just like, if you want to see the lunar eclipse, look to your right in about an hour and a half's time. It was amazing. Got to watch the whole thing.
There you go.
So what was really cool about this was it was a super moon. And what this means is it's a full moon at its closest approach to the Earth. And that makes it look 14% bigger than normal. So we have this super, super moon and a lunar eclipse at the same time. Lunar eclipses are not that rare. They happen like every half to 2.5 years. And they're caused by the Earth moving between the sun and the moon. So the Earth's shadow casts onto the moon. But for it to happen on a full supermoon, that is quite rare and won't happen again until 2033. It last happened in 1982. So, yeah, pretty special.
Hopefully we'll still be around for that.
Yeah, I hope so too. Machines won't quite have got us yet. And the interesting thing, why did it look red? Well, that is because Earth has an atmosphere. If Earth didn't have an atmosphere, it wouldn't have looked red. But the sun rays, even as we block out the sunlight going towards the moon, some of the light is refracted through our atmosphere. And because there's different colours in the light, the red wavelengths are able to travel through the atmosphere much more easily than the blue. And so only really the red light makes it to the moon and then it's reflected back to us and it looks red. Yeah, so there we go.
Science fact.
I did not know that till I started my research. But I can see why people would have thought that it's giving rise to doomsday predictions. I mean, it's a pretty scary omen. Well, your science news story, new trends in commercial machine learning.
Yeah, so there seems to be lots of interesting things that are currently happening in machine learning, especially the kind of commercialization of what was kind of cutting edge research only very recently. So there seems to be this huge trend of very, very famous academics from all around the world who are moving to large companies over the last number of years. I guess it probably started with Jeff Hinton from Canada. There was Andrew Ngh.
Who's Jeff Hinton? What does he do?
These are like kind of, you know, world famous machine learning researchers. And actually the trend seems to be, it's the people in deep learning, which is kind of these big machine learning systems that seem to learn very efficiently from large amounts of data. So ImageNet, you might have heard of, is one such example where they try to classify objects and images, but they have millions and millions. I mean, they use the internet to get as many images as possible. So it's a very particular type of machine learning, but it's quite an interesting trend to see this moving out of the universities into the companies and, you know, what we're going to be able to see in the very near future on the high street.
And why do you think that is? Is that because in our world of big data and our connected world, it just is becoming commercially, like, you want to be able to process that data and it's becoming like a commercial interest? Or why do you think we are seeing this trend?
I think from a company point of view, it's kind of competitive advantage. Like, if you get an Android phone or an Apple phone, they're both similar size, like similar, I hope we don't get sued. yeah, similar quality photos, even the interface looks kind of similar. So it's very hard to compete on these small things. So I think large companies like this are both looking for ways to innovate their own service that they provide to users. And then they're trying to look for new sectors which they can get into. So from Facebook, they now have the little auto tag. I'm not sure if you've seen that. They'll like tag your friends.
Facial recognition stuff.
That's all from Jan LeCun's work and his team.
So that's like a machine learning thing where it's learning to recognize those similar faces.
So I mean, the body of the team that now runs the Facebook machine learning group is actually from New York University, NYU, and moved over maybe a couple of years ago, but it's all very, very current and recent.
That's so cool. And so what else might be an example of the kind of more commercial machine learning?
Yeah, so I mean, the obvious ones are kind of self-driving cars, which everyone has heard to death. But I think some of the really interesting things emerge not just from, kind of consumer technologies and stuff, but also things related to healthcare. I know there's problems in this country and pretty much every other country with regards to health services, NHS, the same back home and everywhere else. But there seems to be a lot of machine learning approaches, not just to look at like the biological system and how to treat patients, but how to deal systematically with patients. So there's an interesting guy, Glenn Colopy, in Oxford with me, and he's looking at when people leave the ICU, the intensive care unit, and they're kind of at the next stage, and there's like less nurses, there's less facilities, and you want to be able to gauge, if it looks like anything's about to happen, so you can look between patients and you can try to monitor a whole bunch of things like their heartbeats, etc. And you want to try to do early warning systems to make the system as efficient as possible while still obviously keeping the humans in the loop. But I think these kind of technologies really could have major effects in the society, really.
So it's basically getting machines to help you monitor when a patient is stable and when a patient is actually needs some attention.
Yeah, exactly. I can't imagine the Terminator kicking down the door anytime soon, but I think we will see kind of incremental smart solutions that help in kind of everyday life, which will be good.
And do you think now that it's commercial, that's going to happen more quickly than just university funded?
Yeah, so I think, if I have my figures correct, I think Google bought DeepMind for £400 million for basically a group of researchers and maybe some patents. There was no didn't seem to be any physical good that they were buying. I can bet my eye teeth that Google would like money back some say. I think DeepMind have 5 years, I'm pretty sure, to start commercializing their technology.
So wait, what is the DeepMind technology?
So DeepMind is basically a company of machine learning, computer vision,
So it's not one product, it's just the company, and they're making lots of headway.
They're a company, yeah. I think they're probably their most famous thing that they're doing at the moment is they're training machine learning systems to play the old like kind of 1980 games.
Really?
So, yeah. They use a thing called reinforcement learning. And
so can they like beat the computer?
Oh yeah, like they're like for a whole bunch of the games where you get your reward very directly. So you shoot a little space thing or something like that, like, and your score immediately goes up. Those ones, it's kind of like they complete the game no problem and stuff like that, so they're very good. And they don't even train it, they don't they don't tell it how the game is programmed. They just give it like the pixels from the screen, so the way a human would see it, and the controls that a human would have, and just get it to play. So it's quite interesting to see these kind of things. I'm not sure how that one exactly would be commercial, but I'm sure they will be using these same kind of ideas and concepts to do interesting things for Google and
that's
others.
Absolutely fascinating. Okay, we're going to look at more about how they actually managed to program those machines later in the show. But now it's time for a little bit more music. So Jack, what are we going to have now?
Space Odyssey.
But why have you chosen Space Odyssey?
In order to link into, I guess, the lunar and Mars news.
Very nicely done.
The papers
We were just discussing in the studio, it's actually quite a depressing song.
It really is, yeah.
Kind of stuck far away and no one's answering. Yeah, sad times. Anyway,
I
moving.
The next song could be more cheery.
Well, yeah, well, let's hope. I mean, it's up to you, right?
We'll sort of something out.
So moving on, I would like to find out a little bit more about you, Jack, and how you got into machine learning. So before we get into the complications of it, I think we need to go back a bit more to basics. Yeah, how did you start?
Probably all started like a number of years ago, like a good number of years ago when I took...
When you were five.
When I was six. So there's a number of online courses for anyone who wants to get involved in computer science or wants to learn a bit more maths or science generally. And the ones I found were quite good at the time were a company called Coursera.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave an online course in machine learning. I found it really interesting. And from there, I took some of the recommended texts and then read them and, you know, eventually got into it that way. There was a robotics club at my old university, at Trinity College of Dublin.
Have you ever built a robot?
Well, I have been involved in the building process, I would say. I worked a bit on the computer vision of one of
You sound like this is something you're embarrassed about.
No. It's just there's like obviously a big team of people and like some people put a lot of effort into it. So I'm very conscious that those people definitely, you know, deserve a lot of credit towards that. So I don't want to take anyone's shining light.
Stealing the thunder,
exactly.
So it wasn't a one-man robot war team.
It wasn't, unfortunately. I wish I was Iron Man, but unfortunately that's not the case.
Did your robot have a name?
Ooh, I don't think so. At the time we just had simple camera systems and we had to try to keep the robot on the road, basically. We wanted it to be able to drive around Trinity College back in Dublin. Which is like, you know, I mean, in hindsight, something that people know how to do. But it was quite an interesting thing to actually go ahead and build it from, you know.
Building like a mini version of a self-driving car.
Yeah, exactly. Except without, so we were only really using cameras. So a lot of the self-driving cars now have LiDAR, which make things, I mean, the amount of problems that they run into are far greater than what we were looking at, obviously.
Yeah.
But, so LiDAR is kind of like, you basically have a laser, you spin it around, and you look at how the light bounces back to you. And from that, you build up kind of a 3D map, and you do a thing called SLAM. Like SLAM! which is like simultaneous localization and mapping. And from that, you kind of map out your environment and, you know, don't hit things. I think that's kind of the goal.
Yeah,
so
definitely.
We were a little bit more primitive than that. We just had camera systems. And yeah, we wanted to... Yeah, like we knew what the roads looked like, so, you know, stay on road. That's kind of the general gist of it, yeah.
Follow the yellow brick road. Okay, so you were at university, you were doing computer science, and then you went to America and worked at the Jet Propulsion Lab with NASA. And can you tell us more about what you were doing there?
Yeah, sure. So I was in the Bio-Inspired Technologies group.
I mean, that sounds like a great name.
It's a fantastic name. Actually, the guy who runs it is a guy called Dr. Thomas Liu, and he's like... really interesting character, but he got to rename the group, so I think he picked a nice one.
And what were you doing there?
Yeah, so the group does a range of different things, mostly focused around kind of optics and vision. So there was projects that ranged from kind of optical communication between satellites, so mm-hmm. that was one thing, through to more kind of regular security type threats. So what I was looking at the time, mostly through that project, was automated surveillance systems. So for example, if you're at a train station or an airport, people are there with their bags and stuff like that. You don't want them to leave behind bags.
It's helping to spot the terrorist threat, right?
Exactly.
Like an unintended bag is a massive...
It's a massive threat, yeah. So it was brought on by that, and we thought, you know... So the Jet Propulsion Laboratory is like funded 80% by NASA and 20% by other contracts. So some of them are security related contracts and stuff like that. So it was well inside our group's range to be working on surveillance projects. And so, I mean, during that period, we built a number of surveillance systems to try to identify these risks, mostly bags being left behind. You can also look at things like traffic And you look at cars, you can identify when cars aren't doing what they're meant to be doing. So if somebody like abandons a car at the side of the road, you know, you can do this automatically. You don't need people staring at a screen to be able to spot that. That's quite an obvious long-term change. So while the motivation was from kind of a terrorist threat type thing, the applications are a bit broader.
Yeah, and I think you're explaining to me before how the sort of benefit of having these automated systems is that we have so many cameras in our country. I think if
4.3 million approximately.
Yeah, like one of the most surveillanced societies. And of course, you don't have 4.3 million sitting watching each of these cameras. You have far, far less people. So the benefits of a system that can alert, oh, here's an unidentified bag, and then a human can go and look at it. That was the point, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And so we're definitely not the only people who were looking at these type of problems. There are a number of private companies that do similar things. But then I presume there's also government organizations that do stuff that we never hear about, but that's kind of a side point. So there's just really the efficiency. We don't have the manpower to be. It's like what I was saying about the nurses in the hospitals. We just don't have the capacity to be able to, you know, care for every camera or care for every patient or whatever, you know, at that seriously large scale. So it's then how do you kind of increase efficiency? And one way of doing that is obviously trying to bring the attention of your resources, your people, your staff to what seem to be, or at least appear to be, the most prominent threats.
Amazing. Yeah. Now, very simply, how would you program something to learn if a bag is unidentified?
Yeah, sure. So one thing you have to bear in mind is that whenever you take a picture or you have a video stream, you know, kind of a digital recording, or I mean, even the music that we're playing here today, we haven't been playing vinyl. Is that...
That's absolutely yeah. We're very digital here at Soho Radio.
So, you know, basically we just have this sequence of numbers. So if you take a picture, you basically have, you know, usually it's stored in like red, green, blue values.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got three numbers. Usually they're stored between like 0 and 255.
Anyone who's ever used Photoshop should be familiar with this, I think. And each colour has a particular value, a particular number for the blue, the red and the green.
Exactly, yeah. I now know that you Photoshop all your Facebook photos, right? No, I'm joking.
Yes, I do. Really very different looking. Thanks for the radio.
So you have these, you just have these grids of numbers, right? And so usually kind of a grid of number in this shape, we refer to them as like matrices. So you have this big matrix of numbers, and then you want to try to find when things change. So one way of doing that is to look at every pixel.
Mm-hmm.
And put together like a probability distribution for like the colors that it has been displaying in the past. So if I set up a camera here, there's a yellow wall, and if, you know, for a single pixel, it might be, you know, because there's noise and stuff like that too with the camera, you won't get the exact same color every time, but it'll be
you'll have like shadows and variations, but it'll be around the yellow color.
Roughly yellow, yeah.
Okay. So you've got your yellow average.
Yellow average. Or if you think of a more complex environment where maybe you have a tree that's swaying in the wind. Maybe you have both a green and black from the ptarmigan. So you have a bimodal distribution, which means you have kind of two colours which you're switching back and forth between.
As the branch sways.
Yeah, but again, these things can be modelled fairly easily. Then when we start seeing purple, you know, purple is quite unlikely to be from the same source as the yellow. And from that, we can identify that, oh, okay, this pixel seems a bit out of place. And so as we're modelling like the previous N for some number of pixels in the past, we can look at when these probability distributions move, and when they do, we say that that's static foreground. So it means that something's been there long enough to change the distribution, so it's static, and it's and then from,
so it's like a new thing in the foreground.
Yeah, exactly. Now bear in mind, this is still just a pixel, like a dot, right? So that doesn't really give you much information. But when you get a whole bunch of these dots that are, you know, together, we can try to figure out, are they connected? And if they are connected and we can find a solid region of like static foreground, maybe even a noisy solid region, then we can do very simple things. Like we can look at the edges and say, is this likely, you know,
is this an object?
Yeah. Is the colors internally and externally, are they quite different? You know, I think that was called color richness. That was like a very early technique. But there's a whole bunch of other ways we can try to find edge pixels. So imagine if we have two neighboring pixels.
So you've got like a whole bunch of these purple in a line. That would be your edge.
Yeah, yeah. So if you have a pixel that's purple and beside it, you're back to your yellow again.
Yeah.
And you find these, they will be considered kind of edge pixels.
Yeah.
Right? Because there's a different, there's like a gradient there. And so if you find a whole bunch of these and you can kind of connect the dots, then that might imply that there's some sort of object there. Now, it doesn't tell you if it's a bag or if it's like a chair or anything. Again, remember, we're not trying to like simulate a brain. We don't have this like real world physical understanding of everything. That's kind of beyond the reach of really any system at the moment. We might be able to give it a label, like the very kind of, you know, Google-esque state of the art. We'll take a picture and we'll label everything for you in the picture. But, you know, you create a new type of, you know, gadget, and it probably won't know what that is until you train it to also recognize that. So understanding what these objects are in a scene is very, very difficult and really beyond the scope of most computer vision, you know, at least commercial computer vision projects. So instead, we're just trying to find these, you know, these kind of blobs, we can think of them.
Yeah.
We can see, you know, can we track someone who's put behind one of these blobs? You know, so we can track moving objects and then try to see if they were connected to this blob and are no longer connected. So you might be able to track whoever left it behind. So maybe if they're like, you know, in the, you know, maybe if they've gone to the bathroom and put down their bag before they went in or something like that. Or maybe they're with a friend and, you know, they...
So they've given it to the other blob.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they've given it to the other blob. So you want to be able to try to figure out in a relatively robust way kind of what's happening to the scene and whether or not this seems as something that's unlikely or likely.
That's so cool. And so if it's unlikely and you say, this is an unlikely event,
yeah,
this movement of the blob is unlikely, then it gets flagged up.
Yeah, we don't call the police and arrest everybody. You just kind of, you flag it as an event that might be.
And then
be.
A human will look at it and interpret it as well.
So one of the really difficult things, actually, and it's not really what we were doing, but is testing these type of things. So there's these like huge test benches with like thousands of, well, when I say huge, not really that huge, maybe thousands of scenarios. Depends what you consider huge nowadays. and you know, often they're kind of man-made situations. So, you know, they don't actually have hundreds of thousands of people who leave bags behind and run away every day. So they have to kind of artificially make them.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, some of the times, because they're artificially made, they're not necessarily the most realistic scenarios.
Yeah. Okay.
And so, you know, we can get like, oh, we got 100% accuracy or 99% accuracy on the training data set. Okay, is that going to actually help us next time? Yeah. You know, it's very hard to actually match these. So sometimes when you hear results, you kind of have to think back, okay, well, what are they testing on? You know, what are they cross-validating on? Do I actually, you know...
Yeah,
is there scenarios that I could break them? I mean, for instance. And if there is, well, then don't break them, but, you know, try to let someone know and then think of a way how to... not let that break stuff like anymore. Yeah,
checking the system, hacking into it. Gosh, that is fascinating. I never thought, just looking at like Facebook saying, do you want to tag this face, how much research must have gone into that beforehand. That's really amazing.
Yeah, so yeah, facial detection and now facial recognition, because they also like try to find which of your friends, I think it is, automatically, which is
they're learning from what you've told them.
Yeah, I know.
I could talk about this all day, but we need to have some more music. So what are we going to
do? Some more music. Okay, because we were talking about the commercialization of things, and a lot of researchers seem to be making a lot of money, and if they want to hire me and give me loads of money, that would be great. But because of
plug
that...
Plug there.
plug. Because of that, I'm going to put on Money. That's what I want.
The best things in life are free, but you can give them to the birds and bees. I need money.
Yes, indeed. This brings us on to a much more interesting point. Well, not more interesting, sorry, I don't know why I said that, but like looking at it from a different point of view, in terms of, we can keep developing these machines, we can keep improving their learning abilities, but are we in danger of the rise of the machines, as it were? Are we in danger of machines taking over, which is, you know, the fear that has spawned many science fiction films, many science fiction books. I mean, we started the show with Back to the Future, and it's the 30th anniversary of that film. It was set coming to 2015. Now, a lot of the things that they envisioned in that film haven't happened. We don't have flying skateboards. Jack's saying maybe we do.
Lex is making one. It's pretty cool looking.
Well, we don't have a hoverboard that, you know, is on the street and all the kids are zooming around on. So we're nearly there, but not quite. And yet that film never, ever envisioned social media. Like, social media is not a thing in that film. And actually, incidentally, Instagram having their fifth birthday this year. That was this week as well. More science news subtly in the show. So, you know, we are living in a world where this could be becoming a reality. And is it something that we want? Is it something that we should be kind of funding and researching and working towards? I mean, we talked about this in another episode, but self-driving cars, yes, more efficient, don't need to sort of have brakes to go to sleep, won't make as many mistakes because they don't get tired. So would save companies money and time, but would also put thousands of people out of jobs. And sort of where do we think that's all going? And is it actually a realistic danger or not? That's kind of what I want to talk about in this section. That was a very long intro. And I also didn't introduce her at the top of the show, but we have a guest producer with us today, Rachel Dobbs. How are you doing, Rachel?
Hi, I'm good.
Great. And Rachel is actually a philosophy student, so she's going to get involved with this chat as well. So, Jack, as the expert here, do you think we're going to be seeing artificial intelligence of the kind that we've seen in science fiction films anytime soon?
Yeah, no, absolutely not. Like, I mean, we're nowhere near creating, like, actual human-level intelligence. There was actually these seminars that run at Oxford on strong AI, I think they were called. And I remember there's a professor that, in our group, kind of adjacent group, called Frank Wood. And he's a really smart guy, but he was going through, you know, some of the common jobs that humans do, and we're trying to break down. Now, obviously, there's a lot of jobs. We can make a lot of jobs more efficient, but total replacement, some of them are very difficult. I mean, just the challenges, I think we're nowhere close to really getting. And the level of robots for a Terminator to come in, I mean, we're a long, long way away from this. There is a bit of a hype around it. And people should speculate about the future. I think that's not a bad thing. There's some books like Super Intelligence. That was a big book that came out during the year and got a lot of, you know, got retweeted by Elon Musk and a whole bunch of other very famous people, which kind of said that, you know, the human race was going to go one of two ways. We're either going to enhance embryos to be these super intelligent beings, or we were going to have better and better AI machine learning until eventually, you know, they kind of took over. I think both of them are massive speculations. As you said, we couldn't have envisioned
social media.
And there was a very smart guy called Stephen who said to me recently that it's very difficult to predict the future because every once in a while something happens that you just cannot possibly foresee. I mean, at the moment, one of the things that really holds a lot of technologies back is batteries. I wouldn't say we're useless at making batteries.
No, but they are developing a really efficient battery, aren't they? That charges in like 2 seconds and has 4,000 hours of life. Well, I need to check these facts, but they are developing more efficient batteries.
Yeah, it seems to be problems that people have been working on for a very long period of time. And hopefully these things do come out and do work and are scalable and aren't too expensive and all the rest. But, you know, there's a lot of things between here and anything like that, I think, is the real case.
But are we in the danger of replacing our workforce with robots?
Why are we in danger? I think it sounds great, right? I mean, at the moment, I work like all of the time. It would be great if, you know, I could work half of the time and then just like chill on a beach, you know, right? I think we're probably not going to be able to replace everybody's job anytime soon, but we're definitely going to be making your jobs more efficient. And there has been, even to this date, a huge number of jobs that have become more and more efficient, and yet the employee is getting paid roughly the same as what they were, you know, obviously after inflation and stuff, you know, quite a few number of years ago, like, you know, maybe 30 years ago or whatever, and yet you're getting more work done. So does that mean that the company owners, the boards, the investors make more money, or does that mean that
we're just offering a better service?
We're offering a better service. Does that mean that the demand of humans, like, now I kind of expect to have internet on my phone everywhere I go, and when I don't, I get kind of like, on the tube, why is there no service on the tube? They have it in Paris.
Yeah,
they should have it in London, right? So you kind of get annoyed that you don't have these things, which means the requirements go up, which means we need to keep doing more stuff in order to get over them. But if it is the case that we kind of plateau on how much work needs to be done, and we can kind of outsource more and more of this to technology, it makes us question that, like, you know, does it really fit in with the quite capitalist model, or does it fit in better with a more socialist model?
What do you mean by that?
Well, so, I mean, if fewer and fewer people do all the work and reap all of the reward, and if there was fewer and fewer jobs, now, I don't think that's necessarily going to be the case, but it could easily be the case during a transition period. you know, equivalent to the Industrial Revolution or something like that, when a lot of traditional workers may have lost their jobs before new jobs were created.
Mm-hmm.
And if that is the case, then should we be heavily penalizing people on social welfare, or should we be trying to, you know, kind of look out for one another as kind of a society and help try to like take into account the fact that we're going through an unprecedented period of time?
What do you think, Rachel?
I'm inclined to agree that I don't think that the automation of jobs or certain parts of jobs is necessarily a bad thing. And I agree that you could probably make the same argument at any stage in history in which, you know, you have technology which improves the efficiency of what you can do, allows sort of man and machine to work together. And in general, that kind of technology has always eventually created more jobs and more opportunities as kind of society as a whole.
So it sort of goes through a bottleneck and then we adjust.
Yeah, that's what I think.
Great. So actually lots to look forward to maybe, and excitement ahead. Cool. Well, we are actually coming up to the end of the show, so we need to really quickly play our next song. Then we're going to be revealing the answer to our Monty Hall problem. So Jack, what's next?
Mr. Roboto.
How apt.
You're wondering who I am.
Secret, secret, I've got a secret.
Machine or mannequin.
Secret, secret, I've got a secret.
With parts made.
So, at the top of the show, we gave you a problem, the Monty Hall problem, which was that if you were faced like a contestant on a game show with three doors, behind one door is a car, behind the other two doors is only a goat. You win whatever you choose. You choose your door. The game show host opens a door that you didn't choose and shows you the goat. So, there's now one third door left. Do you stay with your original choice, or do you switch and change the door in order to win the car? Jack, can you please reveal statistically what should everyone do?
Probabilistically.
Probabilistically.
You should always switch in that scenario. So you're twice as likely to win if you switch.
Why? That just doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, so if you think about it, there's kind of three scenarios. One is if you actually chose the right door in the first place, in which case it doesn't matter which door they opened. So that's one out of three. But in both other scenarios, once you pick your door, he has to open the door that doesn't have the car behind it.
Yeah.
Which means if you switch, you get the car. So two out of three times, you'll get the car if you switch.
Ah, very well explained.
Voila.
And so that's mapping, that's like looking at the scenarios and mapping the probability of it, right?
Basically,
and
yeah.
That's what you do with machine learning.
Yeah, so we look at Bayesian machine learning, which is probabilistic. It drives, everything derives from the basic laws of probability theory. So that's, yeah, it's the kind of a flavor of probability and, you know, a basic example of the type of things that we might be thinking of.
And that's what you're working on at the moment. So very, very briefly, how is what you're doing different to what you did before?
Before, I was looking at very applied scenarios, very specific, in which case you can create something that kind of will work on a one-off type basis. Now I look at more general machine learning. Well, general supervised machine learning. So we get input-output pairs and we try to understand that relationship.
Having an input and output in a black box and you're trying to work out what's going on.
The relationship between the input and output. But that's not necessarily to do with security cameras. That's not necessarily to do with healthcare systems. This is for the general case, which we can then apply to a whole range of applications. And so I've moved slightly more theory than before.
So rather than looking at one application, you're now looking at a general.
Yeah, you have to understand the maths and the probability a bit deeper. And you want to be doing stuff that will work for a whole range of applications for a whole range of people around the world.
That's so exciting. Good luck with that. That's amazing.
Thank you very much.
And thank you so much for joining me today. It's been absolutely fascinating. As someone who is not very computer savvy, I feel like I have learned a lot today.
Well, it was a pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you to Rachel for being a fantastic guest producer. We've all been enjoying the tweets. So what are we going to play out on?
So to finish off, I just want to show you that we weren't all nerds. One of the guys who sits beside me in the lab and probably the most decent guy I've ever met, Johnny Dowling, is in a band called The Silences, who are unbelievable. They tour around. They've been playing at Electric Picnic in Ireland and whatnot. And my favourite song by them is Santa Cruz. So take it away.
Shout out to Silences.
It's time for leaving.